Great. Good morning, everyone, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for having me here. My name is Aman Khanna. I'm a agribusiness private sector development advisor, and I'm currently working with the bank on, as I said, pulling together learnings from Asia. I have what makes my job easier is that we can hear right from the horse's mouth. We have people from India, Thailand, and Cambodia, the focus countries. So I can probably play the role of pulling everything together and giving you a bird's eye view.
Aman, could you speak slowly, please?
The translators.
A bit slowly and then onto the mic so that we can hear you. Thank you.
Sure. Right. So, So I was saying it is a privilege and a pleasure to be here. And I am going to speak about learnings from Asia that we can bring on board to consider and perhaps identify how they can be contextualized or made relevant for us here in West Africa. I have the fortune of having people from India, Cambodia, and Thailand already here, which makes my job perhaps a little easier, but there I can therefore take the opportunity of giving you a bird's eye view, and the details I'm sure will be discussed during our deliberations. That was slow enough, I guess. Let me start with this very often quoted saying by this famous philosopher, Spanish philosopher: those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. But you might be wondering why I'm talking about this in a workshop like this. Someone very recently, even equally famously, said, but those who learn from the past of others have the opportunity to leapfrog and do even better than those that they learned from. And I say this because even though the Asian countries have done extremely well, we all know that, often they've not learned from their own past, and some mistakes perhaps have been repeated. We see how India reacted at the food price crisis in a knee-jerk fashion and affected the world prices. We see how Thailand, despite its traditionally strong handling of the rice value chain, is in the recent past being criticized for its rice pledging scheme and so on. So it's important to learn from those who are successful, but equally important to learn from what they did not do right, as it is to learn from what they did right, because often we Asians continue to repeat our mistakes, and given that we have to do it faster out here in West Africa, it's important to be deliberate. Very quickly, a snapshot on where we are. This consultation workshop, and I stress on the word consultation, is to ensure that what I have been able to, with the support of other people at the World Bank, been able to pull together from desk research primarily and some primary interviews what has gone right in Asian countries. But it's extremely important to consult with you to make sure that what we are talking about can be made relevant and can be made applicable to West Africa. So the primary purpose of this workshop is to share with you what we have learned from a desk research and from some primary interviews, and a basic understanding of West African context, which we will enrich as we spend time here, to ensure that what we learn, which is probably at a 100,000 feet level, but relevant, can be customized for our own requirements. I would request everyone to, obviously when one sees learning experiences, one thinks about, oh, this is in a different context. But we remember that there are a lot of similarities, and because this is a consultation brainstorming exercise, we can be more positive in terms of how, instead of saying that this is not applicable, perhaps saying how can it be made applicable. Quickly, the background and context I'll speak about to start with, and then I'll delve into the story of each of the focus countries, and I'll close with guiding principles and next steps. We all know this, so I won't spend too much time, but the chart on the left tells you the yawning gap between production and imports. The blue line at the bottom on the left chart is really production in West Africa in the ECOWAS countries, and it is encouraging to know, when you look at the numbers, that the growth in production has been higher. If you look at every decade since up to the last 5 decades, the growth of production in West Africa is actually higher than the world growth of production. So we are doing well. But at the same time, we are developing very fast. Our per capita income is increasing very, very fast, even though population may not be increasing as much as it has in the past in Asia. Therefore, even when we are doing very well in terms of increasing production better than the rest of the world, we are still staring at that yawning gap between the orange and the blue lines. On the right, you see how important it is for us to look at this. I don't need to emphasize this, but that chart really talks about how I've been given this pointer, but I guess I'll talk about what's on the right and on the left. It works better for me. The chart on the right tells you what share of our gross domestic product we are actually spending on importing rice. Now, those are official figures. So as someone very correctly pointed out, Benin seems to be importing 10%, spending 10% of its GDP on rice, which is probably not true because a lot of it is going into Nigeria. But the fact remains that if you look at the ECOWAS region, we are spending between 1 to 2% of our gross domestic product on importing. An interesting statistic here is that India, for example, often criticized for the heavy subsidization of fertilizers and price control, spends about the same amount, about 1% of its GDP on fertilizer subsidies and food subsidies. The difference really being, if we are spending 1% going out of the country at a very high level, can that 1% in India, even if it is distorting the market, it is actually creating jobs within the country. It is actually going to players within the country. So we are spending 1% almost at a regional level of our GDP on importing. That 1% could actually be reallocated, if you look at it at a very broad level, to developing, spending more on agriculture, on rice, to ensure that we, even if it's subsidies, you know, we're not saying subsidies are great, but oftentimes in a food security situation, very deliberately, off and on, it has worked in the past. Why we want to learn from Asia is that clearly there's context is similar. Smallholders prevail. India has 80% smallholders. Cambodia about the same. Thailand slightly less, but still dominated by smallholders. Our palate in West Africa is very aligned to Asian rice. There was aid or import dependency when these countries turned around. Thailand was getting a lot of aid from the United States. India was again getting PL 480, we used to call it, a lot of food aid from the United States when the turnaround happened. There was aid and import dependency. Cambodia continues to have some level of dependency. There was a low level of irrigation in the Asian countries as we have it here in some countries at that time when the transformation happened. So, and at least in Southeast Asia, there was a role of regional play between the Mekong sub-region. So there are a lot of similarities. While one can say that's a different context, there is certainly a lot to learn from there. Very quickly, we chose, there are a lot of Asian countries, a lot of them export beyond just the three that we're talking about, but we had to be focused. So we took a host of criteria, primarily including the scale, the competitiveness measured as net exports, speed of turnaround, because for us we have lost some ground, lost some time, so we have to do this faster. So the speed of turnaround and context comparability. We looked at these four parameters and we broke them down into quantitative parameters to really come up with the prioritized set of countries, India, Thailand and Cambodia. India is that big bubble on the top right. The size of the bubble is production. The color of the bubble indicates how familiar or how similar the context is. Back in the 60s, India had a very, very similar context to what we see in rural areas in Nigeria. Of course, there are differences in terms of rural urban concentrations was not so much in India. Irrigated share was higher, but at the same time there were smallholders and you know the context largely was quite similar. Cambodia has turned around extremely fast. It's only less than 10 years since they've turned around, and now Cambodia is commanding premium prices. In some cases, and in one variety of fragrant rice, the Cambodian prices are actually even higher than Thailand. So something has gone right, so we should learn from them. And Thailand, of course, is the big daddy out there. We can't not learn from Thailand if you're talking about rice, even if it's a middle-income country, so therefore a little further away in terms of how comparable it may be in terms of context. Before I get into the learnings from each country, I want to talk about something that Abdullahi and my other colleagues mentioned. We have to look beyond growing more rice. Self-sufficiency is not just about growing more rice. It is about the right quantity, the right quality, the right available at the right time and at the right place. It sounds extremely simplistic to say this, but it is important to talk about these, because the right quantity is perhaps the only thing you can control at the farm. Everything else has to be controlled beyond the farm. Quality to an extent, using the right inputs, extension services, making sure farmers are growing the right it properly, but really it's only the quantity that you can control at the farm level. In terms of quality, not wasting much in the chain, making sure there is addition of value, and value addition does not mean milling. Milling is the most basic form of value addition. Value addition is unbundling a 100 kg bag into 5 kg bags. Value addition is putting a brand on it. Value addition is advertising. Value addition is making sure that it is polished and nice and looks great. We're talking urban customers here. So all of that happens beyond the farm. So we have to look beyond the farm. It's out of quantity, quality, time and place. It's only quantity that we can control on the farm. And when I say time, it's really about imports are available in huge stocks in Asian countries that can come here any time. But we need to have systems like warehouse receipts or public supported storage. We need to have storage again that's in the chain, that's not on the farm, or at best near the farm. And at the right, by right place, I mean the distribution network, which is part of value addition. The distribution network has to be in place. So to repeat, quantity is the only thing we can control on the farm. Everything else, we have to look beyond the chain. This is a busy slide. I will leave it with you to look at in the form of a printout later. But two important points here. Across the world, in a smallholder context, the market failure is dealing with smallholders and sourcing from smallholders is high transaction cost. Therefore, you need public support. Therefore, you need policy support and so on. But in the case of West Africa, there is another market failure. That market failure is that the imports have already taken over. The imports in the structural adjustment period, which perhaps arguably happened a little too soon, 30 years ago, let imports come in and take over our urban market. So the other market failure in West Africa is that our own urban market demand is not available to our own farmers. The high value that one can derive, which was available in India, which was available in Thailand, is not available to us because imports have already invaded into us, taken that away. So there are two market failures. Again, a reason the market failure on smallholder farmers is present in every context. But the market failure of my own country's demand, my own country's urban demand not being available to me as a producer, that is a market failure that is prevalent only here. It's a unique case. And therefore, we need to look at millers. And I see sir nodding there. I completely agree with what you said. We need support for millers. And I'll talk about what kind of support. It is not just outgrowers, but a lot of different kinds of support. But because there's a market failure in our own demand not being available to us, we need to do more on the other side of the chain. Now, I want to tell you a story about each of these countries. I know the specifics will come from the experts, and I cannot even hope to come close to the level of their expertise, them having been involved in these chains close to the ground for so long. But I want to tell you the story of India, how it went about. And it's important to talk about the evolution right from the time that it was independent up to now in Cambodia and Thailand, and that's how we'll be able to appreciate. So India's transformation has been relatively recent. If you look at the x-axis, I'm sorry the screen is not that big, but it starts from 1961 and goes up to 2016. The orange line is the export. So it has taken a lot of decades, a lot of years to get to the transformation India has seen. It has been a long, arduous process, but the seeds, pun unintended, the seeds of this transformation were laid way back in 1960. The first seed, if I could call it that, was land reform was undertaken immediately after independence. And that has been so crucial. The pride of ownership has come about because land reform was undertaken. I know this is not relevant to rice, but it is important. When we're talking about rice, we have to talk about the larger agriculture policies. Before independence in 1947, India was, rice growth was negative. Okay. I tend to accelerate. I'm sorry, I'll slow down again. Before independence in 1947, India was, rice growth was negative. But the policymakers immediately after independence decided to set the record straight. Land reform, irrigation investment, and research, not just investment, but making research institutions free from political interference. The head of the research institute used to be a bureaucrat, he was changed to be a research scientist. Basic things were corrected, so to speak, and it started growing. Rice production started growing immediately after independence. But just like we were in for a rude shock in 2008 when the food price crisis happened, India had that rude shock in 1965-66 when there were two successive droughts. And aid from the United States, which was flowing in, the policymakers had kind of become complacent to it. Arguably, like perhaps before 2008, we had become complacent to it. But when that happened, policymakers recognized how bad just dependence on aid can be, and how even it can, at that point at least, or the United States at least at that point, could impact even sovereignty concerns. So everything was set right, even though the irrigation and those things were being done. In 1965, all the investment that had been done on irrigation and on, more importantly, on research was brought into action. And we know the rest of the story, the Green Revolution everyone knows about. Seeds development, inbreds were done, mostly no hybrids, even now very, very few, were developed with the right kind of collaborations. So that turnaround, policymakers recognize that this is not something we can continue to be dependent on. However, the approach, even some African countries took the same approach of taking over the entire food supply chain. The Food Corporation of India was set up, which guaranteed minimum prices to farmers, making sure that they were incentivized to produce and supplied at a maximum retail price, a minimum support price for the producers, a maximum retail price for the buyers. That was ensured by the Food Corporation of India, and everything in between was taken care of by the Food Corporation of India. But there are important exceptions to it. The Food Corporation of India was set up to manage largely this price imbalance and the logistics. For a country of India's scale, private sector at that point did not have the capacity to manage a distribution network of this size. But the most important activity of milling, the government did not touch it. In fact, it encouraged it. Soft loans, technology transfer was made possible for milling. And there was no obsession with doing large-scale mills. In fact, you would be surprised that until 1997, milling as an activity in India was reserved for small-scale industries. You could not do larger mills even if you wanted to till 1997. And 1997 turnaround was long behind the country. There was a reason, because millers, the small guys out there, whom we often forget and get a big outgrower to come and work with the farmers, the small guys know how to work with the farmers. They have relationships with them. They may be inefficient because they're smaller, but in milling, really, one can grow on a line-by-line basis. So scale economies are important, but not crucial. Small millers have networks with farmers. If we short-circuit small millers, we are trying to create a parallel chain and do something that took ages in a short period of time. These small millers, the Food Corporation of India often criticized for taking over the entire chain, did not touch. In fact, they were encouraged, not just through soft loans and everything, they were given a minimum utilization guarantee. The government made its job of procurement at the minimum support price easier by mandating the millers to purchase for them. Now, this policy is criticized now in hindsight as being distortionary, but at that point of time, there was no large-scale capacity. These small millers, A small guy who was an agent to a farmer in a small village in India was just buying and selling paddy. When better improved varieties came about and there was a, you know, 5 times increase in paddy, these small entrepreneurs got into action. They knew that their investment would be guaranteed a 75% utilization, so with a minimum return. So as what we call a baniya in India, as a smart entrepreneur, a small entrepreneur, I knew that if I put my money, just by making sure I'm procuring 75% of the capacity for the government, I am taking care of my returns. And the balance 25% I will make my money on. I will sell it in the commercial market and I have a top up. Plus, all these small millers had strong relationships with farmers. So they were able to source. Sourcing that we often see as a challenge for our growers was never a challenge, because I am the guy who is in the area. I know the farmers and I am also giving them credit. So I have a deeper relationship. I help the guy when he needs, to pay for a death in the family or anything. So that relationship was leveraged, not sidelined. That's probably an important learning for us out here, in terms of it is nice and good to do large outdoor arrangements, but it's also important to get the small guys pulled into the chain. And if the high value of imported, you know, replacement urban demand is available to us, then there is space for another layer in the chain. There is space for small miller selling to a large miller, polisher selling to a distribution network, or perhaps an importer investing in the domestic distribution. Because the higher value of urban markets is available to us, we can afford to get another layer in the chain. So let's not ignore the small mills. They are equally important and they don't have procurement challenges. And of course, the third and the more challenging, besides outgrower and getting small more millers to sustain, is having farmer-owned or cooperative-owned mills. But again, cooperative-owned mills cannot have the distribution strength. So their partnerships with importers may be relevant. I am talking to the extent that I learned about West Africa from secondary research. I expect to be educated here. To the extent that I learned about that, I'm talking about what could be relevant, but you know, I don't claim to be the authority. But really, besides outgrowers, we can have small millers pulled into the chain. Another layer in the milling value chain can be built in, because that enables us to get a higher margin. When I look at the value chain cost buildup in Nigeria, in other West African countries, it shows me that imported rice sells more expensive. So there is an upside available. If that upside is available, that can be shared with one more value chain participant, a larger miller, a polisher, a branding, a consumer products company even, could take care of the front end and source from the smaller millers. So private sector milling was facilitated. Another important thing for milling was the government machinery supported and encouraged a single variety to be grown in a single area. So there were millers did not face challenges in separating out different varieties. They still had the challenge of separating out to an extent different moisture content and different maturity, but that is relatively simple. I'm not a milling expert, but I know if the varieties are different, it's more difficult to separate them. If the moisture content is different, you can put in a dryer, you can do stuff to control that. So the government machinery was put into action to make sure that one variety was grown in one area. Credit is the lifeblood. So banks were nationalized, arguably perhaps not the best thing to do, but that unleashed a lot of credit into the system. The small entrepreneurs could get credit, the millers could get credit. The network of cooperative societies at the apex level, state level, village level were built. So all of this led to a situation where by the mid-1990s, when the overall economy liberalized, the so-called structural transformation started taking place in the mid-90s, by which time the domestic sector had the breathing time to become ready before imports were allowed in. Imports were completely restricted before that. So when in the mid-90s imports were opened, private sector was ready. By giving utilization guarantees in the beginning, soft loans and technology transfer, public sector on the negative side, one can say distorted private sector incentives, but really encouraged private sector, because nobody would have put a mill without a 75% utilization guarantee at that point. So, but by that time, in the mid-90s, millers were ready, and Basmati started to, as the premium variety, started to, entrepreneurs recognized that there is a higher value available, and they started exporting. So that slight bump in the road or in the chart that you see was the first Basmati shipment going out. So really, when liberalization happened, private sector had been given its time to get the breathing time to be successful. After that, one can argue whether, and that's why I say whether we should blanketly learn everything from India or not. There have been, you know, this whole up and down in the chart that you see in the food price crisis shows that there was overreaction in terms of import control. So perhaps even after liberalization, India has been very, very controlling of the export and import flows. But overall, liberalization led to a situation, and all these building blocks that I spoke about along the way led to a situation from 2010, we see that cliff out there in terms of growth in exports. So I spent a lot of time in India. I know I don't have too much time, and I have to, again, I think, decelerate and speak a little slower. So I hope this gave you a good perspective. There will be repeat learnings in Cambodia and Thailand, which I will rush through. But to summarize, you know, there were building blocks that were built throughout. Before import was allowed, milling remained small sector, and it was encouraged to be small sector. Credit was unleashed, and a net, one thing I missed to mention was, besides what the Food Corporation of India sourced, it was only 25-30% of the production that the Food Corporation of India sourced. The 70% of the production was really going through the normal chain, and to enable that full commercial chain, to enable that, agriculture markets, what we call mandis in India, the agriculture produce marketing company, some 7,000 markets were set up. That was all public investment. Now private markets are coming up. But those were set up, those markets provided an opportunity for farmers to come and get a competitive bidding undertaken. Not all of that has really happened, but the intent was that competitive bidding for the produce was happening. That was a location that helped in consolidation and grading. So even while when one talks about India, one is overawed or, you know, discouraged by the whole Food Corporation of India taking over the whole chain, more than 50% of it was commercial. It was going with in public investment in areas where the private sector was not capable, and the private sector was given breathing time to get to a situation where it could be capacitated to export. Cambodia is at the other end of the spectrum, has had of, and you know, I'm not the authority, I'm sure the people from Cambodia will speak much more eloquently about this, but from what I have seen, was conflict affected. It used to be an exporter, but because of conflict in the early 70s, exports disappeared and import dependency came about. But in 2010, the policymakers recognized the importance of rice to the economy. And a policy which is very, very well written in terms of being, you know, defining the timelines for what they want to achieve, recognizing that we don't want to do everything. We want to focus on rice. We want to focus on milling in rice, though we will not forget the other links in the chain. And it was driven right from the top. It was driven by the Prime Minister. So in 2010, this pathway, this very well thought through. When I don't mean to be critical, but when I see the strategies across the world, not just in West Africa, then I see a penchant for wanting to do everything. Let's solve all the problems. No, this strategy was very clear in terms of saying, we will solve milling. We will look at the other parts of the chain, but we'll solve milling. We will make sure. And the policy was very comprehensive and time-bound. And it was driven right from the top. So that's why from 2010, paddy was getting exported to the neighboring big exporters, Vietnam on one side and Thailand on the other side. It was getting exported as paddy. And from there, value addition was being done, and it was exported to West Africa, to other parts of the world, the US, home Mali, and so on. But after 2010, you see the orange line that's starting to come down. Milling, unmilled rice export started to go down. And the blue line at the bottom, milled rice export. And as I said, the other important element of Cambodia's rapid transformation has been they have focused on the front end of the chain also. Not to say that input support was not provided, but when I say front end support, standards, making sure that SPS requirements were met. The SPS requirements for them were for exports, but our urban customer has standards which, you know, are not SPS, but they are standards if which we might have to support the industry to meet. So that front end support that was provided for meeting global international standards, you know, ensured that higher margin was available, and then even the small millers could share in that. If there is a margin in the industry of 10 and you want 10 people there, it's difficult, but if that margin becomes 15, then you know you can have even 12 players there. It's as simple mathematics as that. Because a higher market was made accessible to the domestic chain, small millers aligned to larger millers to so almost like the automotive industry, there's a tiered sourcing structure. The large mills sourcing from the small mills, also sourcing from the farmers or the polishers or the exporters, focusing on exports. As an exporter, my capability is to know my customer, brand, package, label, everything. I don't want to get into milling. Let the miller do that. As long as I'm getting a better price, I can share more. And once that higher price is made accessible, in the case of Cambodia, Thailand, it was exports. In the case of West Africa, it's the urban market. Once that higher margin is available, private sector, you know, comes around to share the spoils in that sense. Again, that's not to say that no input support is required. At the end of the day, someone in India said to me, which resonates, is that every link in the chain has to be independently sustainable. I see a lot of literature talking about there is lack of trust between players. Why should they trust each other? They are selling, I'm giving you a service, you're paying me money. Outdoor arrangements, great, trust is needed. And you know, there's a contractual arrangement, understood. That's a separate story. But in every part of the world, except perhaps in the auto industry, the buyer does not invest in the seller. Seller is independently sustainable. So let's make our farmers independently sustainable, so that if he wants to sell to an outgrower, he wants to get tied into a chain, well and good. If he does not, he has a market to sell it to. If he does not want to go to the market, he has the agent who picks it up from his farm. So it's really about making sure that the farmer has enough choices, and that takes public investment. Input networks take time to develop. But again, if the higher value is available, a lot of that can be shared and the markets align. In India, fertilizer and pesticides, everything is subsidized. Fertilizer is less subsidized now, but it still continues to be. But again, just like in milling, the distribution is all private sector. Prices are controlled, but the distribution is private sector. Seeds, distribution is, multiplication is private sector. So one can't say blanket private sector or blanket public sector. One has to, if private sector capacity is not there, one has to build that up. Every segment in the chain has to be independently sustainable. Having said that, of course, I'll move to Thailand. Thailand, of course, is the big daddy out there in terms of, it's been a traditional exporter. You don't see any, you know, very big ups and downs in the chain. But a few important elements. From my understanding, when I read about Thailand, I see that Thailand is very intelligently managed producer and consumer incentives. Way back, Thailand was left, right, and center taxing rice, and it was, farmers were allowed to go and, you know, get as much land as possible. So there was a free hand to grow. Land expansion, extensivization was happening, and rice export was being taxed. Thailand realized that we are kings in rice, so we can tax it. You know, the world has to buy it from us. Again, this might sound very high level, but we are kings as West Africa in cocoa, right? So recognizing what we can tax and what we need to support becomes extremely important. So until the mid-70s, Thailand was highly taxing rice export, but was still being able to do that because there was no one else. In the mid-70s, they realized that, you know, now it's become more competitive. So it turned around. So before 70s, consumers were in a way subsidized at the cost of the producer by taxing producers. But producers were given a free hand. The negative side of that is that there was a lot of deforestation. But that aside, after mid-70s, the policy turned on its head and consumer support started to be provided. If you look at this one, the bottom orange line, that's the per capita consumption. Mid-70s, per capita consumption had stabilized. It was actually starting to go down. So the policymakers recognized that, okay, we are taken care of in terms of our self-sufficiency and people are moving beyond rice now. So we can start to support our producers for exports and let the consumer fend for himself. So that balancing consumer and producer incentives was, in hindsight, I see very, very well managed, whether it was deliberate or it was something that just happened. We can learn from the Thai representative. But really, being able to manage producer and consumer incentives was done very well. Again, land reform in the mid-70s was taken off with the World Bank and with some other support to make sure that extensification had gone to a limit, and it was time to intensify. So it was time to make sure that farmers could have the pride of ownership of their land and invest in it. And focus from extensive irrigation was switched to micro and mini irrigation. So the whole mid-70s, the whole policy making very dynamically changed to respond to the requirements. Now, in the recent past, of course, there have been concerns with the rice pledge scheme, though it started as something to support the producers. I think the very important caveat when we talk about heavily policy dominated environments like India is that it's good to have an FCI when private sector capacity was not there and so on, policy support, but governance is extremely important. When governance goes for a toss, when populist political considerations come into policy making, then it goes for a toss. So that's probably what's happened both in India and Thailand. Being successfully evolved into great big exporters, India now has a subsidy bill which is mounting, even though the farmers costs are the same, the minimum support price has been increasing. In Thailand, the pledge support scheme has gone, you know, beyond rationale now with double the market price being given to farmers. So I want to caveat that while it is important for policy to support, it's also important to be very, very clear on the governance. Right, so I don't know how much time I've taken, I've probably exceeded, but I'll quickly close with the guiding principles. There's a detailed report that's coming out after this, and we'll probably have another discussion a few weeks down the line with the full findings once we have had the chance to incorporate your inputs. But at this point, looking at how the Asians handled their rice value chain, it is very clear, a few things are very clear. A custodianship approach to development of the chain was taken. And when I say a custodianship approach, I really mean that there was no single-minded focus on one segment. Dynamically, as was needed by the context at that time, consumer and producer incentives were balanced, as we saw in the case of India, in the case of Thailand. Focusing beyond the production, which I've spoken about, continuously monitoring and maintaining consumer interests and producer interests. At this point, we are perhaps by letting more and more, in the past at least, letting more and more imports in, we are biased towards consumer interests, but the producer needs to be incentivized to continue to grow. And if the urban market, high value market is made accessible, even if it means some public support to access it, that will flow back to the farmer. Inevitably, it will flow back to the farmer. Scale and milling, I think I spent a lot of time on that, so I won't leave this behind with you. That's my guiding principle number four. Quality upgradation requires a market-driven approach. Clearly, knowing SPS requirements just like that, knowing the urban consumers' requirements, we need to start. And it's fine, as I said, to have multiple layers in the chain. The small millers can align to the large millers. The outgrower arrangement can be a contract farming, can be a contract manufacturing, contract milling arrangement. If the large mill has challenges dealing with farmers, it is obvious, right? The farmer's never seen that big daddy coming from somewhere and putting up a large mill here. Why don't we let the small guys source and source from them? Because we have the high value market available and we can share that back. This is all conceptual, I know, but we expect to be, you know, challenged and criticized constructively at the end of this so that we can make it more relevant. Maybe I'm talking at a level which is completely irrelevant, but I'm sure there is some resonance in what we're learning from there. Regional linkages matter. In Cambodia, paddy was flowing across the border, but paddy export was not banned. Instead, FDI from Thailand was invited. So Thai companies, millers have invested heavily in Cambodia, and at least that value addition is staying within Cambodia now. So, you know, regional synergies, the way it could manifest in West Africa, as someone was saying, our fertilizer requirements at a country level are low, and therefore our import costs are high. Can we consolidate procurement? Again, it's a concept, but we need to be more integrated and leverage regional synergies, perhaps, to be able to import or you know, have the right kind of pricing for fertilizers. That's just one example, but regional synergies we have seen, not in the case of India, there's hardly any synergy in the SAARC region, but in the Southeast Asian region, Cambodia has leveraged Thailand investment to be able to come to the level that it has. I'll close with a very quick set of questions. I cannot claim to be, as I keep saying, anything near an expert on West Africa, and I hope to be slightly more so after our interactions here. But could the hundreds of just these questions which we can think about, and we can maybe use these, Marcel, for creating the TOR along with Hiroshi's points, could the hundreds of small milling units across the region be incentivized to upgrade or align to urban demand? And as I said, when that demand is available, more layers in the chain can exist. Spend on agriculture and credit to agriculture are both, when I look at the figures in West Africa, lower than each of these countries. The percentage of total expenditure on agriculture is much higher in other regions. And it's open to thinking. Thailand's revenues, government revenues way back in the 60s were 30% from taxing rice. Because it was almost a monopoly in the export market. Aren't we the monopoly, last I checked, in cocoa in the world market? Just leaving that thought behind. Can we increase our spend and leverage our advantages? Private partnerships in near farm infrastructure can be very useful. The network of, so could private partnerships be leveraged? And public-private partnership doesn't have to be a big investor tying up with the government. It can be small. You know, investment in a near farm cleaning, grading, sorting unit, which a matching grant or which some soft finance or guarantees provided to a small guy, small miller to become the supplier to a large outgrower or a larger miller. Could that be explored? Near farm infrastructure, because that's when we can ensure, that's what needs public support, that's when we can ensure more is going back to the farmer. Support at the front end is needed, so local brand building and the distribution network requires a lot of investment. That is where scale is important. You can't do small scale branding, you can't do small scale milling. So in the front end, can we think of innovative ways of supporting the branding and the packaging and the distribution network, or get our importers to nudge our importers with negative positive incentives to source. I think a lot of that is already being done in Senegal. I hear there are mandates for importers to also source rice from domestic sources, but just leaving it out there. In conjunction with all of these, sporadic controls are not such a bad thing, you know, because this is a food security item. Import-export controls, very deliberately, if and when needed, as the private sector is developing, are certainly something that can and should be explored. Commercial banks in Thailand and in India were mandated to give credit to agriculture. And agriculture globally, even in the US, everywhere, needs to be, we all know, needs support. So credit mandates to banks that's criticized as distortion, but it has worked in Thailand even better than in India, because in Thailand, I understand, credit of banks were, commercial banks were forced to give X% of their loan book out to not just agriculture, but agribusiness to the millers and so on. Even in India, for milling, there was a mandate to make sure that commercial banks were lending to them, besides doing a cooperative bank network that India did also. Again, consolidated procurement I spoke about, if that could be looked at. But a big caveat at the end of this, I recognize that there are peculiarities in West Africa. The fact that imports have already invaded, and therefore accessing that urban high-value market becomes challenging. That's different. That was not the case in any of these countries. There's a different rural-urban split. India is still less concentrated in urban centers than West African countries are now. So the fact that there is a greater urban concentration is both an opportunity and a challenge. Opportunity because you have that higher value available to distribute through the chain. Challenge because it requires networks, roads, and everything to get to the urban market. So that's different, and I recognize that we can't copy paste those learnings because there's a head start for imports. There's a more concentrated urban poverty. There are different ecologies. You know, at that point of time when the transformation happened, irrigation was low in India, but it has developed. So in terms of ecosystems, again, upland ecosystem is more prevalent here. That was not the case. Only now in the last 10 years, the bringing green revolution to East India project has been undertaken to bring the green revolution benefits to the upland. So understood that, you know, there is ecology difference which we'll need to account for when we are looking at these learnings. And the wider consumption palette. And in West Africa, it's actually an advantage that we're not so dependent on rice as India was, or as Thailand and Cambodia are. India has lost out on its coarse grains, millet and so on, because rice and pulses. But in Africa, we are still, so even in a rice conference, I don't mind saying that let's just look beyond rice. There is cassava, and there are other grains which, if we give our consumption palette is a little more spread than it was in Asia. So we can afford to develop other grains also. And lower public investment capacity. So in terms of what's different and what we should recognize before copy-pasting or taking in learnings is the head start enjoyed by imports, the skewed rural-urban split, the different ecologies, the wider consumption palette, and the lower investment capacity that West African nations have compared to Asian nations. So when we look at these questions, we have to obviously be cognizant of the fact that we can't just replicate it exactly. This is my last slide. I think just reiterating that we are looking forward to the interactions here to make sure that all these high-level guiding principles can be made more relevant to West Africa and applicable. Thank you so much for your attention, and looking forward to the interactions and for your constructive criticism.